do have a live stream audience that's out there waiting for us, including probably, hopefully, my mom in South Carolina watching. So I'm John Dankosky. I'd like to welcome you to a series that we call In the Room. This is the room that we're in. It's a series of unconventional conversations with state leaders. We're on the campus of UConn-Stanford to talk to Attorney General William Tong. Before we get started, I'd like to thank some of our sponsors. Sponsors include, let's see, the Mohegan Tribe, Connecticut Business and Industry Association, Eversource, Clifton, Larson, Allen, the Causeway Agency, Express Strategies, Hinckley Allen, and Rothorn Law. So thank you all very much for supporting the Connecticut Mirror. We will be getting to some questions that were sent to us by our Connecticut Mirror members in just a bit. But first, welcome, William Tong. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for coming to Stanford.
I'm happy to be here. It's the first time I've been in Stanford for a long time.
It is the state's southern capital. That's how we consider it. And hi, Mrs. Dankosky.
Yeah, I know. Thanks. Hi, Mom. How long have you lived here?
Since 2000, so 24 years. I graduated from law school and bought a house on Long Ridge Road. And I don't think at the time I wasn't sure I was going to stay, but I knew I wanted to get involved in local government, local politics. And so I met this guy who was the mayor at the time at Toronto's Italian restaurant in Glenbrook, and he was Dan Malloy. And so I stayed.
So you stuck around here. We talk about this all the time. And when I was on the radio, you know, we in Hartford, we had these conversations constantly. This feels like a very different state than the rest of the state. But you work up in Hartford. You live here. Talk about that difference. The fact that we really have a couple different states here, and this feels like a very different place than where the capital is.
Yeah, I think it felt like that when I was a kid. I grew up in the Hartford area and was born in Hartford Hospital, and grew up in Glastonbury and West Hartford, and then went away for school and came back here. And yeah, I mean, it's Red Sox and Yankees or Mets, right? I was careful about that.
You got to throw the Mets fans a bone. Because,
you got
to. I mean, what else do they have?
You know, and poor Jets too. Yeah. But I think the state is much more. So when I was a kid, if you lived in the Hartford area, you only came down here for your passport. There was a passport office in Landmark Square. But other than that, there was no real reason. And I think because of modern transportation, I think because cars now have air conditioning, I mean, things changed. And now the state, I think, is much more, you know, integrated as a whole. And I do think that there are kids who grew up in the Hartford area who are much more comfortable, young people being down here. And so it doesn't quite feel like the tale of two or more states to me.
I think I have this right. You've been on the job almost exactly 5 years, a little bit more than 5 years at this point.
Yeah, I'm in my sixth year.
You're in your sixth year.
Yeah, halfway through it, actually.
What is different about this job than what you expected? When you started running for this, when you said, I want to be Attorney General of the state of Connecticut, and here's some ideas about what I think it's about, and now you've been doing it for a while.
So it's not what's different. It's what is really much the same. What I didn't anticipate when I became an executive, right, in the executive branch and a full-time lawyer in my public service job and running the state's largest law firm, I didn't anticipate that my legislative experience and sort of my personality and skills as a legislator would still be so front and center in what I do as Attorney General. And if I may, for a second. Sure. So our room is separated into two types of people. Former state electeds, usually state legislators, state senators, state representatives, and prosecutors. Mm-hmm. So they're two very different personality and experience types. And so in my first Attorney General meeting of the National Association of Attorneys General, and we're very close, we work on a lot of things together, Democrats and Republicans, but we meet and we often sit in a horseshoe, and it's kind of officious, and we have mics and nameplates and our state flags behind us. And I remember in my first meeting, it was getting a bit heated. My fellow AGs were fighting with each other. getting a little chippy. And at that time, now Secretary of Health and Human Services, former Attorney General Javier Becerra of California, was sitting next to me, right? California, Connecticut. Yeah. And I said to Javier, I said, hey, what's going on? Why are they fighting? And he just shook his head. And I said, man, I thought I left the legislature. And he said, if I may, it's the same shit, man. Yeah. It's the same shit.
Yeah. Well, no, and look, and I can imagine that. I'm actually glad you said in your room. So you think about these colleagues that you work with all the time. This is the group. I think for people who don't maybe understand what the job is, they think, well, you're Connecticut's Attorney General. Yes. Why do you spend so much damn time with the guy from California and all these other people, as opposed to like being here in the state doing Connecticut stuff?
Well, I do spend most of my time here in the state doing Connecticut stuff, but the opioid and addiction crisis is very much Connecticut stuff, mm-hmm. right? I can't take on Purdue Pharma and the Sacklers alone, and neither can California. And I can't take on the climate crisis by myself. I can't take on Meta, Instagram, Facebook, now Ticketmaster and Live Nation. Without the support of my colleagues and 49 other sovereigns. And that's really important, right? Yeah. We exercise the sovereign power of the state of Connecticut when we step into a courtroom or start an investigation or file a lawsuit. And that's a really important, that gives us a really important set of tools and authority. And so we figured out, actually, generations before me figured out that if you linked arms with other states, you were that much more powerful, particularly if you had California and Texas and Florida and New York. And it was Attorney General Blumenthal in his generation of AGs who said, we are tired of waiting for Washington to take on big tobacco. We're going to do it. Mm-hmm. And they did. And they produced the largest ever cash settlement in history, which has helped to cut smoking in half in this country. And so when I say I was surprised that my legislative skills would still be important, it's because in many ways, every day I wake up and I'm Connecticut's chief legal officer, but to do that job effectively, I have to work in coalition with all these other AGs in what is almost a super legislature, right? In which there's no Speaker of the House and everyone's a chairman.
Yeah, right. Okay, so walk me through how exactly it works, though. So you said, I mean, it's very technical, but it's the C's. You sit next to California. That's a pretty good state to sit next to, first of all. But like, how do you build coalitions? How exactly does it work when you say you're going to take on the opioid epidemic? Walk us through how you make phone calls to people or do whatever the hell you have to do to get that ball rolling.
So you have to be present and you do see a difference. For those of us who are legislators, it comes naturally. And frankly, being able to reach across the aisle and talk to Ken Paxton, right? Chris Kobach, Ashley Moody, and to honestly put your weapons down, right? And have a conversation and see each other as human beings. That's a skill if you want to be effective in Hartford, in the General Assembly, you have to develop. And if you were a chairman of a major committee, as I was before I became Attorney General, as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I knew the most important person on my committee was the senior Republican, okay? Because they could help my agenda and be a partner, or they could be a huge problem. And so you have to, A, intuit that and be willing to do that, and also be present. And I think prosecutors who are used to always doing things on their own and you know, having their own prerogative and the power of their office and not rely on other people, they struggle with it. That's why I spend so much time. I do travel a fair bit. I spend so much time face to face with my colleagues. You know, it's not, a Zoom doesn't work, right? You've got to break bread and you've got to sit down. And so I'll give an example. Chris Kobach is the Attorney General of Kansas. I think a lot of people would say that if you stacked us up next to each other in our political positions, we could not be more different. but we get along great. And we do a lot of important multi-state business together, despite our political differences. And because I'm so present, I'm now the vice president of the National Association. And what that means is, all things being equal, I'll likely be the president in a couple of years. And what that actually then ends up meaning is we get to lead on a lot of big cases. And so, as you may know, I lead the national generic drug price fixing case, for example. I led the dissenters in the Purdue Pharma negotiations that produced the $6 billion recovery. So that was me and a handful of states, or only eight of us, plus the district. And when it comes time to engage in a negotiation about allocation, that's a fancy word for how we split up the money. If you've been leading and you've been at the table and you're present, you can get more money, or you can get more than quote unquote your share because you've led and because you've put sweat equity into the project.
But talk about how you like choose what you go after, right? If, I mean, the opioid epidemic, obviously it seems like an obvious one. In some ways that is equivalent to or worse than the scourge of tobacco that your predecessors took on. But walk me through how you decide we're going to do this. We're going to take on ticket pricing, or we're going to take on whatever the hell else, because there's so many things that you could obviously be working together to do. You got to choose.
Actually, no.
No?
They choose us. And what I mean by that is sometimes I get criticized for being too active in multi-state matters and being too active in, in leveraging our national platform to fight all these major battles. But what I ask people when they criticize me for it is, which one do you want me to sit out? Right? You want me to take a pass on the fight against Meta and TikTok to protect our kids? You want me to sit out and not file a case against ExxonMobil? You want me to take a pass on, you know, the antitrust cases against Google and Amazon and Apple? I don't think we can, because, as you said earlier, this is Connecticut business, right? This affects all of us. And there, it's very important to the people in our state. I think what I can choose to do or not do is lean in more or less and lead more or less. And I do tend to my staff's chagrin, run into too many fires sometimes and want to lead. But that's also because George Jepson led, and because Richard Blumenthal led, and Joe Lieberman led, and Clarine Nardi Riddle. And they built a model that it is my good fortune to step into.
So there's so many of these cases that I'd like to get into. My colleague Jan Ellen Spiegel, who covers the environment for the Mirror, wanted me to ask about the status of the state suit against ExxonMobil. So walk me through this suit and what exactly you're hoping to gain, you know, in taking on this gigantic company that's part of, you know, essentially a crisis that threatens humanity on the globe.
Yeah. It's a crisis that for all of us seems overwhelming, right? And you know, in many ways, it's hard not to feel defeated. I had a meeting today actually about fisheries and the way that changing climate is heating up our waters, producing algae blooms, right? The fish we get here in Long Island Sound is very different than the fish we used to get, because the waters are warming and different species are coming, which impacts the populations we have here and striped bass and so on. It's hard as somebody who cares about the sound and cares about our waterways to see that happen. And how can you stop it, right? It feels so much bigger than all of us. But you have to try. And as they say, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? And one thing that we know is that it's going to take a ton of resources to build infrastructure that's resilient, right? To account for sea level rise, to account for extreme weather events, right? To protect what we call in policy world, environmental justice communities, right? People who are disproportionately impacted by the changing climate and don't have the economic or infrastructure resources to shield themselves from it. So when I became Attorney General, I said to my environment chief, I want to take on this crisis and I want to develop a climate case. And he looked at me and said, okay, you know, because he also felt the weight of it and how overwhelming it is. And it took him a couple of years. But he finally, Matt Levine, came to me with his team and he said, we've got it. And I said, what is it? And he said, ExxonMobil has known about climate change and climate science since the 1950s. How do we know this? Because they developed the science, right? And for decades, it was ExxonMobil and Big Oil that developed the science of a changing climate, of sea level rise. They adjusted their drilling platforms to account for sea level rise. And when we were kids, they called it global warming and the ozone layer, right? Remember that? Before it became climate change. And then in the late 70s and early 80s, they turned their back on their own science and began to lie to us about the fact of climate change. And that is a very straightforward case of deception. They lied to us. And under our state's law and under the law of almost every state, you can't lie to people when you sell products. That's basic bedrock consumer protection law. In Connecticut, it's called the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. Every state has an unfair and deceptive acts and practices law. And so we're bringing a very straightforward consumer protection case against ExxonMobil because they lied to us and they've caused incredible damage.
But to loop back to how you started, you were talking about the very many needs that we have in this state to account for and solve for all these problems. So it sounds to me like what you're saying is we need money from them to pay for these things.
Yeah.
You're after their money.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's part of it. Yeah. But I also want them to stop lying to us.
Yep.
And I want them to stop running commercials that claim that they're developing algae as, you know, new whatever biofuel as an alternative, but that's a lie too. We know they're not really doing it.
And that's
called greenwashing.
Yeah,
by the way.
I want to get back though to your predecessors in this case against the tobacco companies, right? So very similarly, right? They had the science,
right?
They developed the science. They knew what was going into their products. They knew that it was going to be addictive to people. They buried the stuff in order to sell more cigarettes. And that's what won the case. So we get this billions and billions of dollars worth of settlements. And what have we seen over the years? Yes, we've cut back on smoking, absolutely. But we've also covered at the Connecticut Mirror for years the fact that an awful lot of the dollars that we got into the state didn't necessarily go where they thought they were going to go. These are dollars that end up going into the general fund, covering other things. They don't go to it. If we get the money from ExxonMobil, is it going to go to pay for the people who've been mostly harmed?
So the answer is yes.
Okay.
But let me respond to that point about tobacco. Some of that is fair. Some of that's not fair. And I'll tell you why. When Attorney General Blumenthal began this effort, 42% of American adults smoked. 42%. Remember, everybody smoked everywhere. Planes, restaurants, right? At one point, they smoked in the House chamber in Hartford. So it has been a Herculean effort to cut that down to something like 11% and to cut the rate of smoking overall in half. And so it has made a huge impact. It was expressly contemplated then that the money that was recovered could be used for expenses already incurred by the states. So it was, you know, money by way of damages, really. We've already spent so much money on protecting the public from this public health disaster known as smoking. We've lost so many people who've died from smoking, and the economic damage has still a huge cost to it. And so a big part of it was to pay us back, okay? And so that I think is an important fact. The other thing that's important to note is, you know, at the end of the day, money is fungible, and right? So money that that was used on public health, for example, still gets appropriated in the General Assembly, and money that may come in from the settlement maybe doesn't need to go to public health because that money's been appropriated from another stream and it goes to cover other expenses, because at the end of the day, it's all one big pot of money. However, that criticism was well taken by all of us attorneys general today. And so to address that concern in opioids, fully 85% of the money goes, well, actually 100% of it, but 85% of it goes to what we call abatement, which is treatment, prevention, and addiction science. 15% goes directly to cities and towns. But the lion's share of that money is going to addressing the issue. And yeah. And it can't be spent to reimburse the state for costs already incurred in addressing the opioid and addiction crisis. It has to be spent forward-looking.
And you specifically built that in, yes. Understanding yes. that a lot of people were critical of how exactly yes. the tobacco money got spent.
But I just think it's important yeah. to note that isn't entirely the full picture when I hear that criticism.
Can we go back to that the suit against ExxonMobil? So, and I'm sure many of you have seen this, 19 Republican attorneys general have petitioned the Supreme Court to try and block this suit. Like, how does that work? Like, what? Why?
I don't know.
So why? Why would the attorney general, including some of your colleagues who you probably spend time with, why would they spend their time and their state's resources trying to block Connecticut from filing a lawsuit against ExxonMobil?
Attorneys general in our community, I think, are one of the very last places in public life and public institutions where Democrats and Republicans work together in good faith. But not
most
all
of the time.
But right. But not all of us, and not all of the time. And we are not fully insulated from the politics of this moment and the breakdown in our ability to work together and extreme voices. And they're there, and we have to deal with them. And that produces what I consider to be, you know, a ridiculous and absurd effort that I expect the Supreme Court to dismiss.
But is their effort, to the best of your understanding, is their effort based on the idea that fossil fuel companies shouldn't have to pay Connecticut these sorts of damages? Is it that they are concerned about the fossil fuel industry in their states being harmed by you?
I don't actually know, because it doesn't make any sense to me. I think the gist of their argument is that we can't bring a suit that affects their states, that somehow our suit against ExxonMobil impacts their sovereignty and their ability to consume and use fossil fuels. I think that's the gist of it, but that's yeah. the best sense I can make of their claim.
But by that reasoning, wouldn't any suit brought by any state that is going to change how a big multinational company works essentially be affecting the sovereignty of other states, right? If you say we can't do a certain thing in Connecticut and the company has to change it, then they have to sell the same product in their other states. It is going to change.
Thank you for making my argument.
Well,
for me.
But
that's why
you...
that's why it's just total nonsense. Yeah. And what I said was, you know, this appears to be a fake lawsuit filed in the land of make believe. That's what it feels like to me. But yeah. just know I well, not everybody knows, but I deal with these dynamics all the time. And the worst example of it was when I got a call on a Friday night before Christmas in 2020 by the Deputy Attorney General, who said, "You got to come back to the office," or actually at that time, "go back to your computer, because we got to get to work, because 18 of your Republican colleagues went to the Supreme Court seeking to overturn the results of the presidential election." I mean, that's where we are as a country, and we are not immune from those forces. But I should still say we still get a lot of important work done despite the volatility of that at times.
Yeah. I'd like to ask about your suit against makers of PFAS chemicals. This is something that's been in the news a lot just in the last couple of days. Many of you probably saw a story in the New York Times just the other day about seemingly an entire wave of lawsuits that are expected in the chemical industry coming now. But you're suing PFAS chemical makers. These are, of course, these forever chemicals that are just about everywhere. It's unclear how dangerous they are. We know that they're dangerous, though. What are you hoping to accomplish specifically with this suit?
I don't think it's unclear. I think it's becoming ever more clear that they're extraordinarily dangerous.
It's clear that they're dangerous. Yeah. It's unclear. I think the science is not entirely clear on just how dangerous they are and what all they can do to people.
But even you asked me what year I was in my service. It's hard to believe I'm in my second term and 6 years in. But when I started, we were having the PFAS conversation then, but it was just beginning. And the science was in a different place than it is now. But now we know that, you know, it's very much linked to liver cancers, right? And prenatal, you know, complications and a whole host of different adverse health effects. We know that that's real. We know that it can lead to cancers in firefighters, by the way, who are disproportionately exposed to PFAS because PFAS is used in firefighting foam, still used in firefighting foam. And so we want them to stop making these products, stop selling these products, develop alternatives to these products. These are things, by the way, John, if I can, I feel like I've gotten a bit technical, but if I can nerd out for a second, we call them injunctive terms when we get to the point where we're settling or where we're winning a case. We ask a court to order that you do certain things and basically that you either agree to an injunction or that someone issue an injunction enjoining you, telling you that you've got to do these things. And so we want them to do all those things and, yes, pay for remediation. Because the cost of that is enormous. In you know, one water system estimated its opening bid to be at $130 million here in Connecticut. And that's just sort of the beginning of the conversation. So it's going to be a number that's probably unknowable, but is likely much bigger than the market cap of all of the companies that we're suing. And we've got to find a way where they take responsibility and pay for their role in this environmental crisis that will be with us for the rest of our lives and beyond.
In large part, though, these companies have been able to do this because of a federal EPA that has been, for decades, ineffective, I think that's a kind way of saying it, in terms of regulating the types of chemicals that are in our environment. I've done some reporting on this, and one of the things that we've learned is that as soon as a certain chemical compound, a certain molecule is found to be hazardous and it is taken out of production, there's the development very quickly of another very similar molecule, which we don't know how dangerous it is because it's allowed to be released into the environment without the EPA actually testing it.
Yeah.
Yes, this is a company problem, but we've got a huge problem in terms of our own regulation of it. How do you take that into account? Because the federal government's allowed these companies to do this for years.
Yeah, this is in part why I'm here, right? In part why this conversation might be interesting to you and why we're talking about these cases. It's because, largely because of the failure of the federal government to act on all of these big fights, that the states, acting with our sovereign authority, because the states are the original building blocks of our country, why the states have to exercise their authority to fill that gap. I say often that litigation is a poor, poor way of setting policy. It's just not, you know, but by the way, by the time I get to it, right, and I have a actionable claim in court, a lot of damage has been done. Okay. So to rely on me to fix these problems as an attorney general is backwards. You need our policymakers to address these issues. But, you know, we acted on opioids and we're acting on social media and Meta, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, because Congress is unable to do anything about it.
But I guess my point is, and maybe I didn't make it clearly enough, it's that Congress, in all those cases you just gave, whether it's opioids or social media or PFAS chemicals, Congress and the federal government has allowed these companies to do this over and over again. If I'm the attorney for one of these companies, I'm like, man, you can sue me all you want, but dude told me I could do it for the last 50 years.
And they're going to say that about firefighting foam and PFAS. I guess that's right as an academic matter. But at the end of the day, the damage is the damage, and it's real, and it's hurting people, and somebody's got to be accountable, and somebody's got to pay to fix the problem. But you know, and I have great respect for our federal delegation, of course, but they, as a body, as public institutions, they struggle, and because of that, we have to step in, and it's not the preferred way of doing it, but we have no choice.
Those of us who've been in the Connecticut media for a long time have chuckled at the fact that that Dick Blumenthal, after 20 years of doing
five
your job,
five terms,
20 years of doing your job, and essentially making the case that you're making about the ineffectiveness of Washington, has now been in Washington for this long a time, and what does he do when he's in Washington? He takes on these exact same issues. He does these exact same things. Have you ever talked to Dick about why he decided to go to the do nothing Senate? Yeah,
you know, we do have a chuckle about it here and there, because I do think he misses this part of the job, and I do think he misses the ability I know that he misses the ability and the power of an attorney general's office to start something. And if you're lucky, to see it all the way through, or to finish something that somebody else began. And so, you know, seeing something all the way through and producing a result is not just gratifying and rewarding, but really meaningful to the people of our state.
Can we talk a bit about your personal story? I'd like to talk about food for a second. We talked about doing this interview while actually cooking, while having aprons on and cooking Chinese food. I love to cook, and yes. So I would have loved to have done that. And maybe
we could still get a
chance to cook at some time. What did you learn working in your family's restaurant?
I learned that people struggle, and that that immigrants and working people, and that people who run small businesses take it from all sides, and they have to make extraordinary sacrifices for their families and for themselves. And they're constantly being squeezed by all these different forces, many of which we talked about. I also learned that two immigrants who came to Hartford, Connecticut with nothing and opened a Chinese restaurant can make every sacrifice, work extraordinarily hard. And in one generation, I can go from the kitchen of my parents' Chinese restaurant to being the attorney general of this state. And I think we know that only happens in one place in this world, and that's in this country.
It is a remarkable thing. It's interesting, though, too, that so many of these immigrant stories, they do center on people coming here and making food for people.
Yeah.
Right. And that there's something kind of powerful about that too. To talk about that piece of it, about feeding people, about making food and having people enjoy what you cook.
Well, I don't think we often stop to think about how essential food service workers really are, and how essential restaurants are, and how essential, you know, supermarkets and grocery stores. And I mean, there has to be a mechanism for delivering nutrition, right? And nourishment, and to sustain us. And I think there's something, there's a real giving element of that, you know, and there's a real generosity to it. And I saw my parents in many ways, you know, exhibit and demonstrate and live that generosity with their employees, with their customers. I think it's also a way to share, you know, who we are and to make us, who may be different than other people or the majority of people, to share who we are and what we're about without just telling them, right? Showing them and inviting them, you know, into a place which is maybe the most important heart of any family, which is a dinner table. I think in that way, it's really meaningful for immigrants, very accessible for immigrants. And it's a way to tell our story to other people. And that's why, you know, I'm going to wrap dumplings with the governor and for Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month.
This is like happening tomorrow.
Yeah, it's happening tomorrow. I hope Ned's at home practicing at the residence his dumpling wrapping skills. But you know, I don't just do it because it's a shtick, which it is. I'm not too proud to admit that. But it's also a way for me not only to show during API Heritage Month, you know, who we are as people and what's important to us, and to share a little bit of our culture, but also to make us more visible. And I often get asked, you know, Mr. Attorney General, what does it mean to you to be an Asian American, you know, in this country, particularly, you know, when there are attacks and violence and hate and discrimination against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders? And you know, my response is simple. It means being invisible. Mm. It means that people don't see us. It means that we're routinely omitted from conversations about race, right? About our history, about our place in this country, in the economy, and in education and academia. And part of my job is to help us be seen. And to make us more visible. Because, by the way, when you're invisible, that makes people unsafe. It puts them at risk because people don't see them. They don't hear from them. And that enables others to take advantage of them. So I think part of the reason why I do this is that so people see us, but also see my parents, you know, and see people like them who fight every single day. And I try when I... And it's because of the way I grew up. I try when I go to a Chinese takeout restaurant or any Asian restaurant, I try to see the workers. I try to acknowledge them because nobody sees them, right? Nobody sees how hard they work, you know, all day, all night. Then they, especially around here, they get in a van and the van takes them to Flushing, right? And they sleep for a few hours and they come back to work and do it again 7 days a week. So I try to acknowledge and thank them for what they do for me and my family.
Well, and you know, another thing, I love to cook, but I've never cooked professionally. God damn, it's hot in the kitchen in a Chinese restaurant.
Really hot.
I mean, it's some of the hardest work you can do. And I think when people order out, they don't exactly get what goes into that. It's brutally hot.
And not to... you know, turn up, you know, this into a pun, but it's like seared into my mind and frankly into my being, right? Because I spent so much time in that hot kitchen, and it's the smells and the sounds. And when I was a little kid, my parents worked 7 days a week. Okay. I never saw my parents. I was raised mostly by my maternal grandmother. And, you know, I would see them briefly. And if I got a chance to go to the restaurant as a really little kid before I started working there, that's when I got to see them. My enduring memory is of the smell of my father. You know, he used to wear these checkered cook's pants, right? And he had a white cook's smock, and it was splattered with soy sauce and oil and, you know, Chinese barbecue sauce and all the sorts of things that you find in a Chinese restaurant kitchen. But it wasn't the sight of him. It was the smell of you know, 12, 15 hours of caked in, baked in Chinese food. And I looked forward to that, and I can still smell it.
Wow. That's a good memory.
Yeah. There's some tough memories too.
Yeah. I'll bet you there's some tough memories. You talked about grocery stores. Do you open up an inquiry into price gouging at grocery stores? Could you talk about how you decided, this is something I'm going to take on? Seriously, walk me through the process of you deciding with your staff or whatever, here's what we're going to do and here's how we're going to do it.
So we're all concerned about inflation. We all know that the cost of food is going up and cost of groceries is going up, and we all feel it. I like almonds. Has anybody tried to buy almonds recently? So expensive. So expensive. I often skip buying almonds in a bag because it's like $15 for a bag. We also encountered during COVID, there was a price gouging investigation and prosecution in the egg industry. I couldn't get involved in that, actually. It was a sort of tri-state thing involving New Jersey and New York and others. But I didn't have the authority that Tish James has to weigh in on that case. And so we've been trying to acquire more price gouging authority. But we see it, and we experience it. In this instance, Bob Duff, who's a state senator from Norwalk and the majority leader, had seen a piece about the profit margins of big supermarket chains going up during COVID. And that got us asking questions. On top of that, we know anecdotally and with some evidence that the profit margins and the cost of packaged goods has gone up considerably. And we're observing phenomena like shrinkflation. Have you heard of that?
You've got the box gets smaller, yeah. Or the amount of stuff that's inside the same size box gets smaller.
So yeah. Bag of Doritos, I love Doritos, right? Bag of Doritos, same bag, looks like the same bag. Maybe in the fine print, there's a disclosure, but there are less Doritos in there.
Don't come after my Doritos.
No, right?
No, right?
You had me as a high-minded foodie, and I just disclosed my love of Doritos.
But okay, so you bring all this together. I want to actually read something. So there's a viewpoints piece. We have a commentary section in the Connecticut Mirror, and a viewpoints piece a guy named Tim Skidgel wrote. I believe it's a waste of time for an attorney general of Connecticut to attempt to rifle through the maze of costs from one store to the next in an effort to determine if there is price fixing. The marketplace will handle whether something is over the affordable limits. Could you respond to Mr. Skidgel?
Sometimes you can't rely on the market because people do take advantage of you, right? Ticketmaster, Live Nation's a good example. When you have a monopoly in one company that controls every step, every aspect of the market, from the venue to the booking to the promotion to the ticketing technology, to the retail sales of tickets, we're going to pay for that, and the market can't fix that. We're captured, right? We're held captive by this monopoly, and the market stopped working.
But
there are many examples of that happening. I sued a Better Way Auto in Naugatuck. They've been treating their customers poorly for a very long time. The market didn't fix that. You know, people could have walked with their feet and shopped elsewhere, but they don't because of a variety of forces, and people get taken advantage of. And that's why we have consumer protection laws.
But maybe we can disaggregate the prices in the grocery store from people wanting to go see Taylor Swift. In that, you need to eat. Your family needs to eat. Mm-hmm. It needs to be something that it's a human right, to be able to get food.
Yeah.
And if you believe that there's collusion, that's one thing. But people can walk with their feet and say, I'm not going to go see Bruce Springsteen. I'm sorry. I love him, but it's too damned expensive. I don't want to give fees to Ticketmaster. Why do you need to get involved?
Which is why it's ever more important for me to get involved, because people depend on the food. They have no choice. Right, they have no choice, and frankly, it may be that a particular market is their only choice because they have limited access to transportation, right? Or there are language barriers. there are a variety of reasons why people can't just choose. We're very lucky, okay? Mm-hmm. And those of us who have the privilege of choosing whether you're going to go to ShopRite or Trader Joe's or Whole Foods, great, okay? You can be a discerning consumer. That's not true for everybody. And by the way, when you have a consolidation of meat producers, right, a handful of them in this country, or a consolidation of packaged goods producers, right? You have behemoths like Procter & Gamble, for example. And I think the number of beef producers is down to like three or four. We pay for that in the form of what we in antitrust law refer to as monopoly rents, right? R-E-N-T-S. We pay a premium because they have control. And we have no alternative, no effective choice but to buy from them. And so that's a reason for me to get involved, because people can't protect themselves without our help.
Okay, so two different things, because I want to get back to the Ticketmaster thing. But while we're still talking about food, though, look, not everyone has access to local meat that's grown in a farm in Connecticut. Some people do. It's expensive. And the farmers will tell you it's expensive because it's really expensive to produce meat that way. There's an awful lot of people who are farming vegetables and bringing them to market, including in some supermarket chains, and they're doing it locally, but it's expensive for them to produce it.
Sure.
Not in big Monsanto-driven factories in Kansas, but right here in Connecticut. And they'll say, actually, you know what, Attorney General, food's expensive because real food, like real food that people need to eat, is expensive to produce.
Yeah.
We shouldn't dumb it down to being as cheap as possible and making sure we have the right bag of Doritos. We should be eating, you know, better stuff that's expensive
to produce. And let's take that into account,
yep.
Right? And let's factor for that. And if somebody wants to buy at a farmer's market or, you know, go to, you know, Palmer's in Darien, for example, and have access and have the financial wherewithal to buy that food, great. But if you don't, right, and you have to go to Stop and Shop, and you're buying whatever the base pork product is, I want to make sure you're not getting gouged, right? I want to make sure you're paying a fair price. And when you have a small number of producers and a small number of retailers who have tremendous power, somebody has to hold them accountable, particularly, by the way, because you know, in a perfect world, the market functions, you know, maybe imperfectly, but it functions. But we don't live in a perfect world, okay? And there are shocks to supply. There are shocks to logistics. There are shocks to the supply chain. There are shocks like COVID. And I know, I'm thankful as a citizen that my fellow attorneys general were on the front lines during COVID protecting all of us from price gouging, because that was happening with eggs.
Sure.
Right? And if nobody raised their hand and say, hey, what the heck is up with the price of eggs, and why did it shoot up so fast? And if we had just said, you know what, let's just let the market work, so many families would have been taken advantage of. Mm. And that's wrong.
I want to get to one more food question, which came from a Connecticut Mirror member. Are you aware of California legislation to ban certain harmful chemical food additives? Six other states have introduced similar legislation. It's important for food safety of seniors and all citizens in Connecticut. Is that something you've looked into?
I'm not aware of the Connecticut law, but I think we're always looking to support efforts to improve food safety and food security. And we're in constant communication with California, so we'll look into that.
Okay, here's another question from a Connecticut Mirror member. What is the status of your investigation into Prospect Medical Holdings and the financial dealings related to Prospect's three Connecticut hospitals? These are Waterbury, Manchester, Rockville. These are various places that end up getting sold. Could you talk to us about the status of
this? So as you can imagine, there's not a whole heck of a lot I can say because we have a pending investigation. The governor, it's been reported, had a meeting with Yale and Prospect. I believe that those conversations are ongoing. But suffice it to say, these hospitals are extraordinarily important and a lot of people depend on them. And I've been very vocal about my concern that it appears that they're willfully failing to provide the health care that they say they're providing. And I'm very concerned that it's putting patients at risk. And hence my investigation. And I can't say more than that, but I and our team in the Office of the Attorney General is on this issue every single day.
These properties were acquired by Yale, correct?
No, not yet. There's a purchase agreement, and now there's a disagreement among Prospect and Yale about that purchase agreement. And, you know, I think all things being equal, we'd like to see that transaction consummated. I think a lot of people would, but it's not there yet.
Here's another question. Other states are investigating firms owning multifamily housing regarding price fixing. The Biden administration is also reportedly looking into this. Is this something that your office is taking a look at?
So this is one that I'm very engaged on, and my office, we're very concerned about it, but I can't say more than that.
You can't say more than that, because we got several questions about this, about predatory practices from landlords. I mean, especially given the outrageous cost of housing just right here in Fairfield County, it does seem like an incredibly important issue. But it's something you can't talk very much about right now.
I can't talk about it at all, except to say that I'm very focused on it and we're engaged.
Talk me through what you can talk about and can't talk about. This is always it's always interesting to me, because I I'm not being a lawyer myself. Explain to me why you can't say more about it.
Well, I think on a lot of these issues writ large, there may be legal proceedings or investigations that are pending, and as the chief civil law enforcement official in our state, I have to be thoughtful and judicious about what I say so as not to prejudice those efforts. The reason why I could say more about Prospect a little bit more is because a lot of it's been said, right, in the press by other people, by me before we commenced our investigation. And so I have to balance what I can and cannot say about pending matters without saying that they're pending.
I figure she's asked this. Are you watching the Donald Trump trials?
Candidly?
Yeah.
No.
No? You're not paying attention?
I mean, I'm paying attention insofar as I read the news. I think what I'm really concerned about is the damage that he has already done to our institutions and the rule of law, the damage that the Dobbs case has done to reproductive freedom and healthcare in this country, the damage the Supreme Court might yet do on mifepristone and medication abortion, and the damage that he intends to do if he gets reelected. And I frankly need to focus my attention and energy on that. And my team is focused on what happens if he wins, because that is it's a very scary prospect. I don't think it will happen, but it could. And we have to prepare for a very different world. And you know, frankly, I'm worried about my colleagues. I don't think I rate, you know, on his scale, but other attorneys general have been very active in holding him accountable. And so we're preparing for a different world if you should win.
Since you mentioned Dobbs, what specifically are you doing, or what are people in your office talking about in terms of providing protections for people who have children who may be coming from other states who are concerned about the restrictive abortion laws in those states?
Yeah, so Connecticut passed a Reproductive Rights Defense Act, and my successor in my seat, Matt Blumenthal, who's now represents Stanford, and Jillian Gilchrist of West Hartford led the way with our help. We passed and that addresses a lot of those issues about making sure that people who come here to Connecticut are protected, and that doctors and healthcare providers can provide care without fear of liability from other people coming in state to try to sue them or pursue them criminally, and not sharing information and data with people about patients' reproductive records and healthcare and background. I'm part of a leadership team that when Dobbs fell, we knew that they would come after, that would just be the beginning. You know, that I think there's a temptation to think that Dobbs and the fall of Roe was the end. And I've tried to remind people that that's just the start of this war. Okay. And it's a war on American women and patients. It's nothing short of that. And they very quickly, they said, by the way, many of my Republican colleagues said, we want to leave it to the states and we don't want a national ban on abortion, except Donald Trump has said that that's exactly what he wants. And they went into federal court in Texas and filed a lawsuit to ban the use of mifepristone, which is one half of the regimen, medication regimen for a medication abortion, which is one half of all abortions in this country. So that's a national ban on abortion, effectively. And they've been successful in that lawsuit in the Fifth Circuit. So Democratic attorneys general went to federal court in Washington state, filed our own action, saying that not only should mifepristone not be banned, but the FDA should make it more available and more accessible to people and not unduly restrict its availability. We were successful in our case. So now you have two competing injunctions, but that case protects the availability of mifepristone in Connecticut right now.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes left. This is a question that came in.
And quick.
Yeah, it went really fast. It's fun to talk to you. 5.5 years in, accomplishment you're most proud of and your biggest disappointment in the job. You can answer in any order you want, understanding that whatever you say last will be the last thing that we say. So you can go disappointment first if you'd like.
I think my disappointment is that we can't get to everything and I can't lead on everything that we want to. I wish that we could have acted sooner on the climate, but it took 2 years to develop that case. I wish we had acted sooner, you know, in responding to COVID. And I know the governor feels that way, but hindsight is 2020. And so those are some of my disappointments. And my biggest disappointment, frankly, is that we're preparing for a second Trump term. And I pray and hope every day that that doesn't happen, but that I should have to do this work is in some ways absurd. And frankly, I will add, I'm disappointed that as hard as we fought, and we were in the case, as hard as we fought, that Dobbs went the way that it did. And that was a huge disappointment, obviously.
That's a lot more disappointments than I was expecting you to list, to frankly. So give me something that you're most proud of 5.5 years in.
I think it's really the everyday consumer protection work that we do. I very often get a handwritten note, usually, or an email from a constituent. Often when somebody has been denied coverage, you know, for a healthcare procedure, and Tom Ryan in my office, who's our insurance and healthcare guy, jumps all over it, makes it happen for people. I don't know how he does it. But it's those little victories, you know, when somebody, you know, bought a car and they had a real problem with it and the dealer was unwilling, a used car dealer often was unwilling to make it right, we get involved and we help somebody. And those are on top of all of the successes that we read about in in opioids, in our national generic drug price fixing case, in taking on the youth vaping industry, in Juul, that is sort of the big shiny object. And no doubt $50 billion from the opioid and addiction industry will make a huge impact. But that's like 20% of what I do. You know, 80% of what I do is the basic blocking and tackling of being the state's chief legal officer. And when I can use that authority to help somebody get coverage, to get a refund, when their flights were canceled during COVID, or to help them because they put a $10,000 or $20,000 deposit on a wedding venue that got canceled because of COVID, when I can help negotiate a resolution on something like that, I often hear about it, and I'm really proud of that work.
Attorney General William Tong, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. It was good
thank
to see
you, John.
Once again.
Nice to see you.
I'd like to thank our audience. I'd also like to thank a whole bunch of folks, UConn, Stanford, and Kathy Harrison for helping to coordinate this event. Thanks to our sponsors once again, the Mohegan Tribe, Connecticut Business and Industry Association, Eversource, Clifton Larson Allen, the Causeway Agency, Express Strategies, Hinckley Allen, and Rothorn Law. Thanks to the Connecticut Mirror team, Bruce Putterman, Elizabeth Hamilton, Chris Nielsen, Claire Dignan, Irene Mackey, Gabby DeBenedictis, Brianna Nelson, who is our events coordinator. They all helped to organize this event. Thanks to all of you. We hope you can join us for the fourth installment of the series In the Room with Treasurer Eric Russell. It's Wednesday, June 26th at the Arts and Ideas Festival at 6 p.m. It's on the main stage on the New Haven Green. We're just going to be sitting there on the green just talking, which is nice. So you can go to our events page right now. When you go to our page at ctmirror.org, I always say this, click on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner. That's how you can support independent journalism, the type that covers not just what the Attorney General is doing, but all of the delegation, everyone at the state capitol. So please do support independent local journalism. Thanks so much for joining us.